Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
And thank you very much, Brian. That is, of course, the voice of our mentor, Brian Brown. This is the Brown Briefly. This is Oh, wait a minute. I'm blasting these guys out. I'm sorry. I forgot. I have to do something to fix that. Hang on, guys. Okay, are you all there? Let me make sure you hear me. Is everybody there?
I hope the audio sounds better on the air than it's sounding.
They do.
Yeah,
it does.
That was awfully garbled, True.
All right, hang on just a minute.
Happened,
hang on just
we'll
a minute.
Take it from here. That was or should have been Brian Brown talking to us from the great beyond and getting us started onto the Brown Briefly. I'm Lynn Kerrigan. I'm going to try to facilitate this show this week. And in the studio here are Bruce Holman, Susan McCabe, Kevin Jones, and Truman O'Brien. Hi, guys. Check in for just a sec.
Howdy, howdy.
Good morning.
This is Susan. Hello.
Okay, guys, hang on. I'm going to fix my
Truman,
sound.
Can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Ooh, no,
you're
no.
Muffled, Truman. Okay. You're very muffled.
I'll fix it.
Yeah, you're very muffled.
Muffled is a kind word for it. It's sort of loud and garbled.
Okay, hang on. I'll fix it.
So we'll let you work on that. Okay. Kevin, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. You know, I was thinking about the audio that we're getting from Truman over Zoom.
Yeah.
Not the problem over the live feeds. It could just be that cable, you know, connecting us in to the computer. But yeah, we're doing good. You know, Susie and I started our victory garden, and we actually have a little table on our south-facing window now, with full of pots with dirt. And today's planting day, so yeah, we're looking forward to that.
That's exciting. Love it. Well, I'm gonna spin around some possible topics from This Was the Week That Was. Do you remember that show where they got online and on TV and kind of did a whirlwind discussion of things that had been happening, then kind of circled back to things? So I was impressed that one, I think it's today, is it tomorrow? That's Earth Day. 50 years ago was 1970s, 421, I think, 1970 Earth Day. We'll come back to that. There's Truman. Also makes me think a lot about what is happening with the presidential overreach and both telling people to stay at home and then saying liberate Minnesota and liberate Virginia and let's suspend immigration and let's suspend Congress. Oh, my goodness. And it made me think about what is happening in the nursing homes and with testing, that there are pockets of people being hit really, really hard by this virus and some not as much. What are we learning about that? But then I also thought a lot about what is it we're expecting from each other, talking about opening the state and is the economy as important, more important than the virus and trying to get it under control? What are we doing about opening the state? And what is it we expect to receive from each other? So that's sort of the thing that we're going to be talking about today. And I don't know how much of it we'll get to, but Susan, pick one and launch in.
Well, as an environmental fanatic, I'll start with Earth Day. And 50 years ago, our own Dennis Hayes and Senator, I can't remember his name, started Earth Day. And it was the beginning of the environmental movement in the United States and in the world. And Dennis Hayes is still with us. He is currently CEO of the Bullitt Foundation and is managing a global 50 years of Earth Day celebration where Of course, he's had to go online, but it is still the largest global environmental movement in existence. And their goal this year is to get the fossil fuel industry under control. And in a way, the pandemic is helping that.
Yeah, when oil is negatively priced, it sort of begins to change the equation.
Yeah, right, right.
Negative $37.
So now they're going to pay us to buy gas? Is that how it works?
Sounds like it. Hey, how's my sound now to you folks?
Kevin. I'm waiting for like all the gas stations on Vashon to change into more like, you know, the machines in Vegas, right? So that when you put your card in, you get gas and you get like, you know, some coinage.
I like it.
That's a great idea.
We even have the new pumps here on Vashon, so I bet it's rigged like that.
So, hey guys, can you hear me now? Okay.
Much better.
Sorry. I had forgotten. For some reason, when we run my sound through the board, it sounds okay to the folks listening, but you guys get blasted.
So I have to go into
my computer and turn it down for you guys. Sorry, I just I'd forgotten that. We were a little late getting hooked up, and so I was a little behind the eight ball. So sorry.
Well, you've got back-to-back shows.
Yeah, yes. Truman O'Brien is our weekly engineer, and he goes right from a live music show to a Zoom show at this point. He's got lots of buttons to push.
Boy, it is
what you call engineer overreach.
It is. That is definitely overreach.
Truman's trying to control the world on us.
Yeah, I'm trying to take your Guardian of the Galaxy role here, and I'm failing drastically.
Yeah, I didn't know engineers could overreach. That's,
yeah. aren't those an oxymoron? Yeah.
Ooh, ouch.
Well, you would
hey,
think.
Y'all.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, as an airline pilot, you'd think I'd be able to handle all this stuff, but it gets the better of me sometimes. So.
And you do.
Thank you.
Overrated, Truman. Yeah. Airline pilots are way overrated.
Yeah, right? I agree.
You should know that.
I agree.
It sounds all like right. There's no VOV autopilot. I guess that's what I mean.
There is right no VOV autopilot. There is not. Sorry. All right. Sorry. Go ahead, Lynn.
That's all right. I was just going to ask y'all where you were in 1970 and how were you affected by what I remember as we had a big oil crisis and a big oil embargo that year. And I remember the lines that were everywhere, all around the block to even get gas and oil, and the realization that burst upon us 50 years ago that we could not sustain our production and use of fossil fuels.
Was it 70 though? I thought it was like 73.
Well, all that came out of, you know, the Earth Day and all of that realization that this you're saying the 73 was the oil embargo.
Yes.
And
correct.
The first embargo.
Yeah.
There was a second one later in the
day. Yeah. It all blends together for me. Kevin, where were you?
Well, you know, I do remember the embargo, and the thing I really remember about it was there's a friend of mine who drove a panel van, and he somehow had the gas gauge calibrated on that. He like literally like three times that summer, like ran out of gas waiting in line for the pump.
Oh.
He's a master.
Yeah. Well, go ahead. Go, sis.
I hate to say this, but I was very pregnant with my first child on Earth Day 1970. He is now a filmmaker in Los Angeles. And I was also very aware of what was going on the planet. As a mother-to-be, I was pretty conscious of what my child would be experiencing. That was also the year that they made the movie Soylent Green. Does everybody remember that?
Yes.
Right.
Where the old people, like us, were
recycled.
Invited. To, speak for myself. Okay, I will. Were invited to go lie down in the room and watch the pretty movie while they put us to sleep, essentially, and turned us into food.
I have to tell you, just quickly, the It's many years ago, I was out at Fort Lewis. I used to work at Fort Lewis, and there was a sign that said mortuary branch. No, excuse me, mortuary office. And then below it, it said food services branch. And I had to take a I had to take a picture of that. And I've since posted it on Facebook to some of my Army buddies, and the response I got was, ooh, Soylent Green, you know. But my comment was, did you ever wonder about those sea rations, you know?
Oh.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, that's what they call vertical integration, is it true?
Oh.
That's it.
So where were you in 1970, Bruce?
I was in graduate school at the University of Texas. And so, you know, Austin, Texas at that time was, you know, Willie Nelson and Armadillo World Headquarters. And, you know, the Austin sort of music scene was just getting going at that point. So it was a fascinating place to be. And being a large, you know, state university, very much attuned. So Earth Day, big demonstrations in the square in front of the tower at the University of Texas, you know, campus basically shut down for the day. It was pretty interesting. Other parts of Texas were not so engaged.
Mm, I'm sure.
Well, and all this was followed, you remember, by extensive research into all of these issues that was buried. And I think that all the research came in 1979 is what I remember from an article that was in the New Yorker, might have been the New York Times, in the last few months, kind of looking back at those days and looking at the research that they knew about the unsustainability of our fossil fuel industry. And it got buried by the industries for a long time. As soon as the politics shifted to Republicans in the White House, you know, by the Reagan era, that research was buried. And now we're coming back to, you know, looking at the damage done to our country in that period of time. It's pretty astounding.
Does anybody remember when Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency, he being a Republican?
1973.
Was it? Thank you, right. Bruce.
I mean, it's very interesting to think about Nixon. We see Nixon as a conservative Republican, but Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, EPA, I mean, that's a whole right. series of governmental regulations, congressional actions, and agencies were created under the Nixon administration. So Republicans at that time were a very different breed of politicians than they are today.
That's right. He also went in to China and opened China up.
Mm-hmm. So, and lots of people argue, and I think it's a reasonable argument, that a conservative, or sort of a what today we would call a middle road Republican, at that time we called them conservative Republicans, but you know, what a middle ground Republican administration could do that a Democratic administration probably would have had much more difficulty doing. You know, it's Nixon's appeal to the great silent majority was an interesting sort of, you know, historic sort of time in which the middle was willing to move fairly left in terms of policies, particularly like environmental policies, under the leadership of somebody from the middle, which is a lesson for us as we look at this upcoming campaign and whether or not, you know, a sort of more extreme right wing candidate like Trump versus a middle of the road candidate like Biden. And Biden may not get your juices flowing, but at least represents that great middle that could possibly take us in some very progressive directions.
Yeah. Kevin?
You know, I was talking to a friend last week about the time of people getting this awareness, right, of environmental issues. And we contrasted that with today's Earth One, Earth Two, right? Depending on which news media you listen to, and people now protesting about open up the economy, gathering in large groups to spread the coronavirus, seemingly ill-informed of the dangers that they're causing to them, their friends, and their family. And how could we be living in this time of lack of awareness. We're more over ignoring the realities, right, that face us. And what we concluded was, when you have like the river in Cincinnati catching fire, as happened back in those days, you have a hard time ignoring that. And so I hope that people also have a hard time ignoring the number of people who have this illness and who are actually expiring from it. But somewhere, I think our challenge is, and this is the thing Bob Ferguson was concerned about when I asked him, what's our biggest threat? It's just perceived reality and people willing to live their lives based on real data. And it's just amazing that we don't have that. So maybe we need another river to catch fire and everybody will get on board.
To me, this kind of segues us toward that idea of the social contract, you know, Rousseau's idea that every civilization has to have a sort of unspoken, sometimes really put to the fire like we're in now, but a set of guidelines that we're all willing to live within. And I think that what sort of shocked me this week, there was a editorial in the paper, I don't remember who wrote it, but it was talking about Americans are needing to remember what sacrifice is all about. And Bruce, when you talked about Nixon pulling together the great generation that lived through World War II and kind of, you know, invoked that spirit where everybody went to work on behalf of the war effort, be it in the military or at home, you know, under restrictions about what could be produced. You know, and now we are into an era of individual rights that is so strong. We've talked about this a lot, you know, where the common good or the commonweal, if you will, is a little bit under threat. And we're having a hard time kind of balancing out individual versus kind of communal rights. I was really surprised to see so many people at the Capitol steps saying we have to open the economy right now. What do y'all think about that?
If you look, there was only like 2,500 people.
But I mean, you got to remember that this virus is not affecting most people in the United States at this point. If you live outside of a major urban center, you know, Vashon, I mean, you know, we've got 4 cases.
Right.
So what you're seeing is places where the virus has not taken off. One of the protesters in Olympia yesterday drove over from Eastern Washington. Eastern Washington's not confronting what we're confronting. Vashon's not confronting what Seattle's confronting. What worries me is that the lack of understanding, and particularly in places like Florida, where Florida's a petri dish just waiting for this to explode. And they've got leadership that's sort of ignoring the social contract, if you will, opening the beaches. You know, they're going to open, restaurants next week. They just don't understand the nature of pandemics and are unwilling to sort of learn. And in one sense, it's this sort of Charles Darwin experience, if you will. Survival of the fittest. I mean, people who ignore what's going on and the reality of it will have consequences, but also for others around them. And that's what's worrisome to me.
To me, it seems to be the exaggeration of the rugged individualist in the United States. Once again, it's a free country. I can do whatever I want. And that presupposes that whatever I want is more important than anybody else. And I heard today, I don't know if it's confirmed, that Kentucky had a spike in cases after the demonstrations. But I that's not confirmed. However, I could see it happening in any of those places where they are gathering and demonstrating to reopen the economy.
Pardon me for interrupting, but the classic example of that is the 1918 pandemic. It really first wave hit. There was a small wave that hit in the spring and early summer in the United States. It was much more virulent in Europe at that point. But then in sort of September, October, it hit, a first wave hit the U.S. in into November. Well, remember, this is 1918, World War One is going on, military governments or governments are sort of suppressing information, so people don't know a lot of what's going on. But November 11th, the armistice is signed. You know, big celebrations all over the country, parades, you know. And I mean, what happened in late November and December, it peaked a second time and twice as bad as the first time. And so that's exactly what you're looking at here, is that sense that if we pull the plug too quickly and open up too quickly, what we're seeing now is just a glimmer of what we're going to see 2 or 3 months from now. And that's what I think some of these political leaders just don't understand.
I heard a contagious disease specialist on NPR yesterday talking about how the phasing in of reopening the economy could continue for 4 years, where we step out, spike, close back in again, step out again, spike, close back in, and it will dramatically and perhaps permanently change the way our American society operates. So we could be doing this until 2025.
Kevin. Yeah, and I think, Susan, the point you're making about listening for the news about spikes in cases where they've had these demonstrations, I think is very relevant, right? We'll see how quickly the virus can move through the population. I know it's likely to be unchanged from what we had before. And I think we mentioned on the last show that there's really two risks. One is the risk of spreading the virus, and which is managed by a certain set of actions. But the other risk of what happens to an individual if they get the virus, and that's a vaccine, right, is the way to do that. So people need to realize, even if the numbers might look a lot better, it doesn't mean that their personal risk is at all changed. And they might just be fine, have some sniffles and recover, or, they might be in there intubated in the hospital. So I think people need to be really conscious that this is a really interesting risk challenge that we're facing as a society.
Well, it's interesting. Apparently the virus is mutating into a number of different strains, mm-hmm. which makes a vaccine even more challenging. They have to tackle the protein that is common to all strains of the virus. Mm-hmm. So that also says if you get one, it doesn't mean you can't get it again, a different strain mm-hmm. of the virus. So social distancing, masks, that sort of thing may be necessary for a long time.
Kevin?
No, we in another example, right, of the things that happen in this organic world we live in. At the risk of being too cynical, I'm just wondering what the Darwin Awards
Kevin, you're Pardon? Dropping out. Kevin, you're dropping out.
Yeah. Let me ask you guys a question. I heard something on NPR that upset me more than I have been upset in quite a while about this sort of question of who are we sacrificing for this. I've been quite kind of astounded at how hard this is hitting in nursing homes, how hard it's hitting African Americans, who they are saying have a lot of underlying conditions like hypertension and obesity and, high cholesterol, diabetes, things that are starting to show in death rates now, not just in chronic conditions. But being an old person and being very aware that in herd animals, the sick and the elderly are cut out of the crowds, quite a lot. And I heard this young man on NPR talking about the need to open the economy before we can't recover from not opening it. And what he clearly said, I've not heard anybody say this so baldly in a long time, but what he said was, why should we protect the elderly? And that would mean that the young people won't have jobs for years and years and years if the economy tanks. And I'm telling you, it pierced me. It was like he was standing there with a sword. And I turned around and I wanted to come through the wires and say, don't you love your grandparents? Did you never have contact with your grandparents? But it made me realize that we are back to animal behavior, trying to really protect ourselves in whatever our own circumstances
call,
are.
Call the herd, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Kev?
I do have to think about the dilemma of people who are millennials and younger. First of all, they got hit with tremendous costs to go to school. And then they're in an economic, sluggish economic recovery of many will claim, although the longest economic recovery we've had in history. But nonetheless, they have already a setback, right? Because of perhaps they have some school debt. And now we have an economy that's sluggish again through no fault of their own, presumably through fault of a slow response at the federal level by many are claiming, and there's plenty of evidence for that. But that doesn't mean that people in that age group don't have to suffer this plight. And I feel for that. And I think the recovery from where we're at needs to address that group of folks. And there are many things that we could build in this country that will help improve things. From a green, zero carbon emission electricity grid, all the way up to the other infrastructure we need to make sure the economy is successful as we come out of this.
Well said. Susan?
I hate to bring it up again, but that was the premise of Soylent Green, essentially that the baby boom was so big that that it suppressed people's jobs, that the old people, the baby boomers, kept the jobs and took them away from the younger people, that the population was so big there wasn't enough to go around, so somebody had to go.
Are we
looking at that? Is that what we are looking at right now?
Well, you know, it was interesting because the docs are starting to say, at least in New York and New Jersey, when they got so hit by so many people flooding their emergency rooms, that they had to make triage decisions. And that means rationing care.
Right.
It means who is best likely to survive this and where should we put our resources. And so it is a new approach to our social contract where we have felt like maybe we've had enough for everybody. And now we don't feel that way right now because we're not seeing it hit everybody equally. Kevin.
Yeah, I'm curious what Bruce thinks on this question, but before that, I think, Susan, that premise is not really, I mean, it's not a reality we have to deal with today. You know, right now we're choosing in this country to allow billions and billions of dollars to go to a very few. And in the face of the fact that we have lots of opportunity for employment to put people to work doing really good things, to transition us to more sustainable, more affordable infrastructure, like the energy generation sector, right? Like that fossil fuel that was supposed to go away 50 years ago, but is still here, and is still damaging our environment, and we're still paying for it in health consequences and other consequences. So I think there's a tremendous future that we can have, but we need the political will. And I don't know, Bruce, if you see if we're back in that same historical it's time that Susan mentions, or you know, if there's a different way forward.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the old Malthusian sort of equation sort of never really works. I mean, it's not a zero sum game in that sense. And what looking historically, I mean, the United States just in the last 120 years has seen two major sort of catastrophes like this. One, not associated with a war or anything like that, but essentially the emergence of the Progressive Era in the early 1900s, late 1890s, early 1900s, just from abuses of the sort of capitalist system, if you will. And you saw what a whole set of reforms come out that basically tried to, the Food and Drug Administration, you know, sort of regulations of corporations. I mean, a whole set of sort of political reforms that came about that attempted to rebalance sort of inequalities in society. And then the Great Depression of the 1930s and the New Deal, and Social Security and I mean, all those kinds of things that come out, job programs that come out of the New Deal. You had a third sort of revolution that occurred in the 1960s and 70s with the Civil Rights Revolution that was driven by a very different, not an economic motivation, but a social justice motivation. Right now, what we see, or I think, looking at it sort of in a broad historical perspective, we have the coming together of two different sort of revolutionary movements. One, sort of a realization that American capitalism at the end of the 20th and the beginning of the 21st century is not sustainable in terms of sort of the one percenters, you know, the sort of great growth of inequalities of wealth that were balanced largely after the New Deal and World War II. Not that you didn't take away inequalities of wealth, but the disparities were much less. So you're seeing that coming together with a real push for social justice on a global scale right now. So I think, sort of going back to this, how the millennials look at it, the millennials will be the Depression and the World War II generation of the next 30 years. They'll come out of this, and I think, depends on how we handle it politically, and right now we're not handling it very well politically, but if it's handled well politically, we're going to see a generation of progressive politics for the next 30 or 40 years that's going to change those imbalances. But right now, you see countries with dynamic leadership who are attacking this problem, like New Zealand and Germany, women leaders who are taking a very, what I would call, progressive humanitarian approach to this. And you look at the United States, and we're in chaos, and we're going to remain in chaos until we get some national leadership that takes over.
Hang on, Kev. Truman, I wondered if you had anything to say about that.
No, the one thing I'm still back with Kevin when we were talking about the burning river. And are we going to have a burning river? And, you know, we actually do right now. They're saying right now in Nepal, this is the first time they've been able to see the Himalayas in a long, long time because of the pollution. And if you're looking at, look at the world maps, the pollution limit or the pollution representative around the world. It's amazing because everything's being shut down. So, maybe that's the burning river. Who knows?
Good point. Kevin?
Well, I was one other thing. we're talking about this specific issue right now with environmental groups in Washington State. We have a law in Washington now that utilities have to get to zero carbon electricity by 2045. That means they have to make a pretty massive investment to get there. Inslee is going to be looking for ways to get the economy going again, right? We lost $6 billion because of the crisis so far, according to the reports that were out last week. So he needs economic stimulus packages. The intersection between the need that we have and the law that tells us that we have to get there is just one, perhaps, of many opportunities that we can really say, let's get behind, this transition. Let's get those folks who are building solar panels, putting them on houses, building solar farms, wind farms, and converting.
You just dropped, Kevin.
Converting to renewable gas instead of natural gas. Those are all technologies that exist today and things that would lead us out to that future. So, we don't know, but I agree with what Bruce said, the political will has to be there. What's our political reaction? I think we have opportunity.
I'm also pretty heartened by Nancy Pelosi and the Dems who are trying to get more monies going into small business and more protections for the worker, because I think what we have yet to learn is kind of the thrust toward protecting corporations and the big banks again. You know, and I even saw under Obama something that surprised me. You know, we talk about this being a long recovery that we've had since that crisis in finances in 2008. But I'll tell you, I think the first 5, maybe 7 years, excuse me, of that recovery was not for the average person. People were in foreclosures with their houses and they could not get loans from the bank. And the people that were bailed out were the big corporations. And it took, excuse me, it took a long time for the average person to start feeling recovery. So I don't hold with the current, you know, outlook that we've had, 12 years of an economic recovery. The banks may have, but the average person did not. And I would like to see some of this policy being held by the Democrats of saying, let us don't make that mistake again and cut off assistance to the people who need it the most to keep the big corporations going. And that's sort of what I'm trying to follow and understand what the fine print is on some of these rescue packages. Does anybody know more about that than me?
I mean, we're waiting to see what comes out, but essentially what the Great Depression of the 1930s was because of structural instabilities in the economy. What we've seen are similar structural instabilities that have been covered by, you know, by rapid growth and by sort of concentration of wealth. But underlying that, and immediately as soon as this coronavirus hit, you saw the weaknesses of those of that economic structure, and it collapsed. You know, and it's going to continue to collapse. I mean, you don't know. You know, I'm not a prognosticator of what the stock market's going to do, but I don't think it's reached bottom yet. And so my sense is you're going to see the kind of economic consequences out of this instability of this economy that you saw in the 1930s with the instability of the economy of the 1920s. And the recovery, I mean, the recovery was a 12-year recovery. I mean, the Depression occurred in 1929. It was not until World War II and the end of World War II. So it was literally almost 20 years before the economy was back into what it was in the 1920s, but a very different economy. And so we could look at it into the 2030s or 2040s before we're back to a stable sort of economy. Not to be a downer, but that's the reality.
Wow. Well, and is the stock market the best measure of the success of our economy? Because all those folks who were not rich still aren't rich. The folks, the 99%, who are still trying to recover are not dependent on the stock market, if you will, in order to do that. Mm-hmm. So maybe gross domestic product and the stock market are not our best measures of the health of our nation. And we need to start looking at other ways to measure the health of our nation.
I agree, Susan. Good point. You know, there's very few people, I don't know the statistics, but not everyone is in the stock market. You know, most Americans live, two paychecks from poverty.
Well, at the same time, though, if you look at people like Boeing, you know, I mean, huge employers like that, if those folks are doing well, you know, I hate to be a sound Republican, but the trickle down does have an effect. You know, I mean, you have those big corporations, Amazon and folks who are, they're making a lot of money, but they're also paying a lot of money and stimulating the economy. So,
yeah, I think the trickle down needs to open the faucets a little wider and spread it more because it trickle isn't enough.
Right.
You know, I think that in regard to testing too, I'm an old public health person. Most of my career has been in public health, and I am sort of appalled that we don't have the resources to test everyone in our country. Did you see that there was a clip on NPR about a birthing center that decided they would test every single person who came in to give birth. And they found that of 211 people that were asymptomatic, 33 of them, which is 1 in 8, were positive for coronavirus. And originally they had been testing people that had fevers, and they did catch another bunch of people who were coming in symptomatic. But for me, the whole idea of public health is to expand the testing into contacts that everyone has been around and find out who exactly has the coronavirus and can infect other people. And until we get to that point of being able to know who's walking around with coronavirus in our midst, I don't think we will have done an adequate job in public health or in recovery, because we could have multiple waves of infections and, you know, kind of not see the end to this coronavirus itself for a long time. Kevin?
Yeah, and it goes back to the social contract, right, of being responsible and governments being responsible about how to really protect their citizenship. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about the cure being worse than the disease, but The Economist this week said that employment, actually, mortality actually went down during the Great Depression. If you think about the way people lose their lives, they lose their lives by commuting to work. Well, we have less of that. Today, the analysis says that mortality is about a wash, with the economy being closed or without it. So I think it's totally false that that more people will lose their lives by shutting down the economy.
You know, at the risk of stating the obvious, that's one of the things that the coronavirus has revealed, and that is, of course, the weakness in our healthcare system. And maybe that would be the one big thing that would come out of the pandemic in the United States, if indeed we elect a progressive government.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting. I just heard, was it last night, where they were talking about the fact that many of the Republicans are saying, boy, now look at what Sweden's done. See, those guys are really, they've got it figured out in terms of the coronavirus. Of course, they have complete socialized medicine there.
So. Whoa, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, well, wait a minute, guys.
And look at their numbers of cases and deaths are far above all the other Norwegian countries.
Right. Yeah.
Are they?
Yeah.
Far, far, far above.
Right. Well, folks, we've got 2 minutes here, so...
Lynn? Hey, Truman.
Yes, ma'am.
Were you able, did you see my note to you about a potential closing song?
I did, and I have it.
And good. And do you have it actually queued up?
It is queued up and ready to roll. So we have, I'm looking here, we got about a minute and a half or so. Do you want to just close with the, it's a very long song, so we can close.
No, I just want the chorus, and I'm going to read this little Holly Hughes poem called Hold Fast. Okay. Last week of August, too soon for falling leaves, fog that rises at dawn, ghosts up the beach, geese lining up in their ragtag V. It holds fast, gives over to each storm, and flows with each rising tide. All winter, it lets go what it can and holds fast to the rest. That's what we'll do come November.
Thanks, everybody.
See y'all next week.
Thanks for listening.
Now you can't always get she was.